So, what do you remember of your very first experience or interest in mathematics?
I had, when I was a little bitty kid, I had sort of a strange idea about what the numbers looked like. And it was, you started at the end of a road, a crossroads. I haven't thought about this in years, by the way. And the numbers started out 1, 2, and then they went into a woods. And then they came out of the woods on a train trestle over a body of water, 4, 5, 6, 7. They went down to 20, and then they turned left and they went off forever. The other thing was that the other earliest memory was my mother was a pianist, and she had a book of, she had a variety of kinds of music which she played, and I remember one of them. I couldn't read the music, I couldn't read the words, the words were in German, but I could read, and they were all numbered 1 through 18. And these were Brahms's Liebeslieder waltzes, opus 52, and there were 18 of them. And I remember the numbers suggested different characters. You know, when I thought about 2, I thought of this da-dum-da-dum, da-dum-da-dum-dum-dum, and 5 was mysterious, and 7 was so sad I wanted to go sit down and cry, and things like that. The one I especially remember was 11, because it was extremely fast. And when I was outside playing as a little kid, my mom wanted to call me in for something. She would open the door and start playing number 11. And I'd be outside and I'd hear it and I'd say, "Okay, guys, gotta go." You know, 3 or 4 or 5 years old, went on inside. The other thing mom used to call me with was Brahms' Emperor Concerto. And I got very fond of the number 5 because I heard it was the fifth emperor, fifth concerto. I didn't know what a concerto was, but I did know what 5 was. So I've always been fascinated with numbers.
So how did that fascination with numbers translate into school math? What you got in
Well,
school?
I was pretty good at it. As a kid that I was in school with, and I found that we could do arithmetic pretty fast, and we had these worksheets, and we'd go through them like lightning. And I'd usually win. On the other hand, he ended up being president of a very large jewelry store, so you know, can't have them all. And then in about sixth grade, I discovered this strange thing called a square root. And one thing that, growing up in New Orleans, every kid goes to Mardi Gras, and eventually you go, if you're on a truck, if you're on a float, and you go buy these throws, the throws are sold by the gross. Now, everybody knew what a gross was. It was 12 dozen, 12 times 12. The kids in New Orleans might not have known a lot of things, but they did know that 12 times 12 was 144. So I knew what a square was, but how could 2 be a square? And eventually I learned the square root algorithm, taking square roots by hand, and that was kind of a fun thing. And I was good at it, apparently. And my 11th grade teacher, algebra teacher, put the Pascal's triangle on board one day. And she told me this many years later. She said, "You were sitting in the front row and you looked at it and your eyes widened and your hand went up. And you had clearly had this aha moment." And she said, "Right then I knew you were going to be a mathematician, even though you didn't know it."
So that's a good lead-in. When did you first begin to realize that you could be or would be a mathematician?
Well, I went to college and I was going to be a chemist because I thought chemistry was cool. You know, chemicals boiling and dyes and things stinking and smelling beautiful and explosions and all the fun things about chemistry. And I went into this course all full of zeal, and the guy talked about nothing but orbitals the entire year. Now, he could have spiced it up talking about mathematical, you know, balancing chemical reaction equations and all the excuse me, all the numbers involved with that. He didn't do that. He talked about orbitals, which I understand are important, but it turned me right off.
So you didn't have labs associated?
Oh, we did have labs.
So you got,
but
some,
they were, yeah, I got something out of it.
They were very cookbook like.
They were kind of elementary.
Yeah.
I thought, gee, this is, you know. I was taking calculus, and then I took advanced calculus. The next year, I said, okay, I'm gonna try geology. And historical geology is absolutely one of the most fascinating things. I mean, you read these, you know, like the Golden Treasury of Natural History and books like that, and you hear all these wonderful names like the Ordovician period and the Silurian and all those, and you think, oh, this is so cool. And this guy made it boring. Oh. That was terrible. I said, I'm not going to be a geologist. What was left? Math. I said, okay, I can do math. I'll be a mathematician. So I went to graduate school. And in graduate school, after a sort of a rough start, when I finally passed my qualifying exams for the PhD on the second try, I began to understand what mathematics really was. And mathematics is this, I don't know what you would call it, a largely internal, largely consistent set of ideas. And when I was listening to a conversation in the coffee room in the LSU math department, my third year there, and these two fellows were talking about, let's see, what was it? The topology, the maximal ideal space of the topological space of continuous functions on 0, 1. And I said, whoa. There's algebra, analysis, and topology all in one sentence. And I realized there's an underlying structure that ties all of mathematics together. And at that point, I began to realize that this is really wonderful stuff. My advisor was Gordon Paul. Gordon was a student of the legendary L.E. Dixon of the Chicago Math Department. And Gordon had a profound influence on me. And I was this sort of lost soul in graduate school there. And he said, you know, I think you'd like number theory. Boy, was he right. He said, why don't you come work for me? I said, okay. And he had a great deal of confidence in his students' abilities. We'd be talking about something, well, I said, well, Dr. Paul, I think this is true. And I'd mentioned some conjecture. And he looked at me with this kind of funny look, and he said, well, you know, if it's true, you'll find a proof. And he told me something else very valuable about writing. He said you should always write your mathematics as if you wanted somebody else to read it. Now, I've read papers, books. You've read papers and books. We've all read papers and books and articles and monographs by people who quite clearly did not have the slightest care about whether anybody would ever read it or not. I've refereed such papers, and I suspect that many mathematicians have, what in the world is going on? I don't care. And then there are others. They just grip you. They grab you by the neck and don't let you go. And, you know, you read something, you read an article or any of the wonderful books by Bill Dunham. You know, you're just captivated. You're drawn right in. Can't put the thing down. And I learned very early to write. I thought that was a great idea. I wrote as if somebody, I wanted people to read it. And I got pretty good at it, apparently. So I went off and became a college professor. In the very first year, I got very good advice from an associate professor who said, don't get mixed up in departmental politics. You write your papers, get your tenure, and then you can get mixed up in departmental politics if you want to. By then, when that happened, I didn't want to. Mm-hmm. And so for, well, let's say the first 13, 14, 15 years was, I'll use the late, great Richard D. Anderson's metaphor. He gave a talk where he had his three careers in mathematics. Mm-hmm. And my first career in mathematics was a researcher. And I did number theory, and I absolutely loved it. And I wrote all these papers, and they were accepted and published, and they still repose quietly in the literature. And after about 12 or 13 years, I said, I'm not going to be Gauss. I'm not going to be Gauss's right elbow. You know, kind of researcher am I? Maybe a moderate third rater, or maybe a really good fourth rater. I don't know. But something else has to happen. And then it happened. I taught a class in number theory. And I was really bad. Have you ever taught a class when you know you have really messed up? That it's simply awful. It's dreadful. You blew it. And you know it. You have that feeling, oh, this was dreadful. And the students, my students, bless their hearts, knew that too. And the final evaluations that they wrote out, these lovely student evaluations, they took me to task in no uncertain terms. And they were extremely eloquent in their denunciation of practically everything I did. That I was sarcastic, arbitrary, inconsiderate, unprepared, unprofessional, this, that, and the other. And I was ugly too, you know. Now this was in the winter quarter of 1982. We were on the quarter system at Virginia Tech in those days. And I looked at those evaluations and I took them home and I burned them in the fireplace. But you know what? You can't burn the words. You can burn books, but you can't burn words. You can burn student evaluations, but you can't burn the words. I said, I got to do something better than this. And then a couple of years later, a couple of friends of my children who were in high school were coming over to Virginia Tech to take math classes, and one of them landed in my class. And I said, I better do something quick, because my kids are going to graduate from high school pretty soon, and I don't want them to go off to college and have a calculus class from the likes of me. So I went to a good friend of mine who had just won a university teaching award. And I said to him, his name was Jack Dudley. I said, Jack, I don't want a teaching award. I know I'll never get a teaching award. I just want to improve my teaching. And he laughed. He said, Bud, get your ego out of the classroom. I said, what do you mean? I said, it's that all? He said, well, that's a start. I said, well, what do you mean by get your ego out of the classroom? He said, looked at me and he said, in a 10-week quarter with a 5-hour calculus class, you're seeing these people 50 hours total. 50 times 50 minutes, actually, not 50 hours. It's 5/6 of 50 hours. That's less than 2 entire days. That's, you know, 50 times 50 minutes, 50 hours. How many minutes is that? It's less than 2 days. 2 days out of your life. What do you care about what a bunch of 20-year-olds who spend a total of less than 2 days out of their life with you think of you? And I said, oh, and I'm telling you, and you know this, that it's those oh moments that really change your life. And I said, well, I think I can do that. And that kind of began the second life as a teacher, mm-hmm. of mathematics. And I got to where, one thing he said was, he said, okay, we're going to have a little quiz here. What's important in your classroom? And I said, well, the students. I said, that's good. I said, what else is important? The subject matter, the mathematics? Yes, you're doing fine, but now, here's the crucial question. What's not important? I said, me. So you got 3 out of 3, kid. You graduate. Now go off and be a teacher. And so I was. Mm-hmm. And I got to where I enjoyed it. And I really got to the point where I loved teaching. Mm-hmm. And I was absolutely astonished one day, about 4 years later, when the teaching committee chair in our department came into my office and said, we are thinking about putting you up for a teaching award. And I had to sit down. My legs got weak. I said, I had no idea. It had not occurred to me that people would put me up for a teaching award. And all the other things that have happened, and there have been a bunch of really good things that have happened, very few of them have actually topped that moment when I was validated, by my colleagues. To use the modern terminology. They thought my teaching was good enough to be honored with an award. So that went on for quite some time, and I got to be a popular teacher for whatever reason. And in the fall of 1998, well, in 1998, a couple of things happened. I went to the winter meeting, which happened to be in Baltimore. And I ran into another fellow named Dudley, Underwood Dudley, Woody Dudley, who said, Bud, I have just become editor of the College Math Journal. The cupboards are bare. Will you write something for me? I said, why me? He said, you did a book review, one of those extended book reviews for the monthly, and it was really very well done. I said, oh, gee, thanks. So I said, what should I write about? He said, well, what are you interested in? So I said, well, I'll come home and I'll send you a list. And I thought back, I'll write about square roots. So I wrote a paper about square roots for the College Math Journal. And it won a prize. I was absolutely blown away. And I wrote a paper about elliptic curves. And it won a prize. And I said to myself, I think I'm on to something. And that was kind of the beginning of my third career as a writer. And I've been a writer ever since. But also in 1998, the math department at Virginia Tech, the department head and one of my very dear colleagues who gave me wonderful advice, including, your job is not to show your students how smart you are, bud. Your job is to show your students how smart they are. I've never forgotten that. They said, we're going to put you up for the MAA Sections Teaching Award. And I said, okay. Didn't think anything of it. And then somehow or other, in the spring, they coerced me into going to the section meeting, the 1999 section meeting at James Madison University, and they gave me the award. And I said to myself, well, gee, if this organization, the Math Association of America, the MAA, which you can set to music and I won't sing it right now, if they think enough of me to give me an award, then I should start hanging out with these people. They seem like real nice folks. And so, since that time, since the fall, since the spring of 1999, I have missed exactly one section meeting of the Maryland, D.C., Virginia section. And that was because I had had cataract surgery. And I didn't think it was wise to drive from Blacksburg to American University the day after having cataract surgery. And even if I had thought so, the higher power than me says, you are not going to do that. No, you are not. Okay. You know about such powers. Mm-hmm. But I will say, And I really enjoyed working with the section. I chaired the teaching committee. That's one thing. In our section, if you receive the section's teaching award, you're on the committee. This is another example of no good deed goes unpunished, as they say. And then I was chair of that committee. And then they asked me to be chair of the program chair, and I did that. And then they elected me governor. And I went to national meetings. And I kept writing these papers. And they kept publishing them. And, you know, and I have gotten so much more out of the Mathematical Association of America than I've given them. That's a wonderful organization. And so here I am, and I guess, well, in 2005, my university said, they made me something called an alumni distinguished professor, which is an extraordinary position. But the most wonderful thing about it along the way was learning all of this beautiful mathematics and telling other people about it. I learned number theory very well. I learned this from Gordon Paul, who was an extraordinary man and worked in binary and quadratic forms, and he loved mathematics. And when I was in graduate school, my last year, I took a class in graph theory and combinatorics. And I didn't know what graph theory and combinatorics were, but I soon found out. And this class was split, the teaching was split between two people. Brooks Reed, who was at LSU, that was his first year at LSU. And he went on to have a very nice career there, and then went to San Marcos, California State San Marcos, had a fine career there, a graph theorist. And he and I wrote a paper, the first paper I ever got published, a joint paper. And I love the title. The title was "Doubly Regular Tournaments Are Equivalent to Skew-Hadamard Matrices." One of the things I love about mathematics is the language, the words. And it was in that class that the other teacher, David Rozell, who eventually became president of the University of Delaware, was a combinatorialist, a student of the legendary Leonard Carlitz, told me about the 731 block design. And he said this was a symmetric, balanced, incomplete block design. More of these wonderful words. And I thought, boy, is that a great name. And I wrote an article many years later for Math Magazine called "The Many Names of 731. And it turns out that 731 is one of these magical mathematical objects that is connected to all sorts of areas in mathematics, both discrete and continuous. So I've gotten a great deal of joy out of mathematics and out of students who have that "oh" moment. When you see the light come on, there is absolutely nothing like that. So that's where I am now.
Okay.
And now the MAA has chosen to ask me to give one of the lectures in the carriage house.
Yes.
And that's just wonderful. I'm so glad.
Now, going backwards a little bit, just to fill in, as an undergraduate, were you also at LSU?
I was at Rice University.
Oh, at Rice.
Right.
That's right.
I was at Rice University. And in fact, I took a class when I was a junior. I took a class in differential equations. It was a year-long class, differential equations first semester, Fourier series and boundary value problems the second semester, and I did very poorly in that class. Mm-hmm. It was not the fault of the university, which was a fine university, or the teacher, B. Frank Jones, who was one of the best mathematics teacher I ever had. You might know that name.
Yes.
He received the Texas Sections Teaching Award several years before I did. And I knew, even though I was not a good math student, that I was in the presence of a great math teacher. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself, if I ever get to be a college professor, I want to be like Frank Jones. And in 2000, I actually gave a talk at Rice, met up with him again 30-something years after taking his class, mm-hmm. and thanked him in person. Mm-hmm. And that was cool.
I actually got to speak with his class twice.
Oh, good.
Because my older son went to Rice.
Mm.
And so I introduced myself while on a visit
yeah.
to see him.
Mm-hmm.
I introduced myself to the math department, and I guess it was Michael Wolf who was the head of the department. This was not too long ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I said I'd be around, and if anyone was interested, I'd be happy to meet anyone who'd be interested in seeing me. And Frank Jones immediately wanted to.
Yeah.
And then immediately invited me, well, why don't you give a talk to my differential equations class? Or actually, well... And I'd add something on soap bubbles and mineral mm-hmm. surfaces and that
yeah.
sort of thing, which
yeah.
he thought was perfect.
Yeah.
All that and various things like that. But he was by far the most interesting and friendliest of the
oh, yeah.
faculty that I met.
Well, but, he, when I, one thing I remember about his classes was that all his notes were on a legal pad, a yellow legal pad, legal length,
mm-hmm.
and he wrote everything on the board, and he had this very deliberate, kindly way of speaking. Mm-hmm. And when I saw him again 37 years later in his office, I asked him, do you still use the yellow legal pad? He said, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Do you still write everything out? He said, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was so Frank Jones was a very strong influence in my career,
mm-hmm.
although not in the way that maybe he might have intended. To get me to see the wonder and the beauty of differential equations.
Mm-hmm. But when you went to LSU, you were already thinking that math was your area.
Yes.
So you had
yes,
enough,
I was certainly
you had
thinking,
enough math that that was.
I had had enough math. I had had exposure to topology
mm-hmm.
and to complex analysis
mm-hmm.
and algebra,
mm-hmm.
and I thought that this was something I really wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
I was very much captivated by a couple of science fiction stories that I got. It was a collection by Clifton Fadiman called Fantasia Mathematica.
I have the book.
Yeah,
yes.
I'm sure. Yeah. And my mother gave that to me for my birthday one year.
Uh-huh.
And I read the stories. And the ones that impressed me were the one about the no-sided professor and the
yes.
one about the island of five colors. And some
mm-hmm.
years later, I went back and looked. And they were by a fella named Martin Gardner. And I was blown away.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever get to meet Martin Gardner?
I never got to meet Martin Gardner. I've met 2 degrees of separation from him by many.
Mm-hmm.
I know many people who were good friends of Martin mm-hmm. Gardner's, and so
yeah.
I'm a sort of a grand friend of his, but I read his columns.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I corresponded with him
mm-hmm.
on occasion on various things, but I did get to meet him once. It was after an MA meeting in Atlanta,
mm-hmm.
and Ron Graham happened to say, and my wife was staying with friends in Asheville, North Carolina,
mm-hmm.
and I was talking with Ron Graham, I was about to leave the meeting and all this, oh, you're in Asheville, that's right next door to Hendersonville, that's where Martin Gardner lives, why don't you give him a call? So when I went back to Asheville,
you did.
Sunday morning, I
yeah.
called, it was in the phone book,
yeah.
I called Martin Gardner,
yeah.
said, oh, Ivers, I've always wanted to meet you, come on over.
What a thrill.
And I said, I'm here with my family and kids,
yeah.
oh, bring them
all
over.
Bring on.
So we were there all Sunday morning in his house, getting
that's
a tour,
fabulous.
Me and the boys got
mm-hmm.
a tour of his amazing, I mean, everything he'd ever written about, all those puzzles and games and
mm-hmm.
those circuits that
yeah.
didn't light up and all that,
right.
they were there. So you can actually walk along these
oh, yeah.
aisles of shelves and things like that, and he would just pull out something, oh, remember this puzzle? And just
oh, some of those, the
yeah.
columns on the puzzles.
Yes.
The one about this guy who would make a puzzle, and he'd send it to this other fella, and if he solved it, he got to keep it for free. And if he didn't solve it, within a year, he had to pay for it.
Uh-huh.
And there was a picture of one of them that just drove the guy nuts. And finally, he had an x-ray, and he realized there was a cavity sitting around there. And the only way he could get the puzzle solved, where you have to get a ball to go through, mm-hmm. was if you had three hands.
Right.
And so he held something down with his foot
right.
and took a needle or something right. like it, poked it through,
yeah.
and that's how he did it.
Yeah.
And the writing of those columns was yes. magical.
Yes. Yeah.
I still remember when I saw the column that was, the title was, A New Kind of Cipher That Would Take Millions of Years to Break.
Yes.
The Introduction to the World of
Yes.
RSA.
Yes. Yeah. Nice application of number theory.
Oh, yes. That's another thing. Number theory for years and years, and G.H. Hardy was extremely proud of this fact,
mm-hmm.
Was very highly regarded as a subject of pure mathematics. It is the oldest mathematics around. Numbers were the first things that people did, then they did figures. And the ancients had a very high regard for numbers. Sometimes they imbued them with mystical properties. People still do that. That's another story.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, G.H. Hardy prized number theory for its great beauty and its great lack of utility.
Mm-hmm.
Says it's beautiful and useless.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was interesting, but I never really gave it a whole lot of thought. And then about 7 or 8 years after I got my doctorate, all of a sudden, there was this brand new thing called public key cryptography,
mm-hmm.
which was a new way to exchange keys and encrypt, where the strength of the security lay in the inability to do a hard problem in number theory.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was just wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Now, another transition that you sort of glided over is a big one for most people who are finishing the graduate school, and that's finding a job.
Oh, yes.
So how did that, did you end up immediately at Virginia Tech?
Yes, I did. And how that came about was, this in 1969, the job market was not yet bad. It got a whole lot worse a few years later.
Mm-hmm.
Even then, it wasn't nearly as bad as it is now for academics. Although, if you're a mathematician, if you major in math and have other skills, I tell my students, and you're diligent and you hustle a bit,
mm-hmm.
you can find work.
Mm-hmm.
Because all sorts of people out there in the technical world do not realize that who they really want to hire is math majors.
Mm-hmm.
Because math majors are smart. And I tell them that, and of course, a lot of they get jobs. Gee,
mm-hmm.
isn't that wonderful? Now I've lost my train of thought. Well, finding a job, yes.
Right.
Well, I wrote to about 20 different places.
Mm-hmm.
Some having to do with the part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wasn't that fussy. I wanted to go off and be a college professor. And one of my colleagues in graduate school told me about this place in Virginia called VPI. And he had gotten hired there, and he suggested that I apply, because he was going to be there brand new the next year. And we'd both start there together. And I said, well, why should I? Well, you know, this is great. Tell me something. Well, they just hired a few years earlier a dynamic young president who is going to build this university, this college, it's mostly agricultural engineering,
mm-hmm.
it had about 10,000 students, into a major university.
Mm-hmm.
And the president, T. Marshall Hahn, did just that. And I said, okay, this sounds like a good place to go. It's in a small town. I've never lived in a small town. And I got hired. And I remember driving into Blacksburg, Virginia with my wife and a 7-week-old baby, who is now 42. And we drove up and down Main Street looking for the downtown, not realizing that we'd driven through the downtown several times.
Mm-hmm.
But if you grow up in New Orleans, your idea of a downtown is kind of warped. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I applied. I got the job offer, sight unseen, and I got an offer of 2 interview trips. But I decided that this seemed like a good place mm-hmm. to go. Mm-hmm. And I've never regretted the decision.
And I mean, you mentioned that your main focus in those early years was research.
Yeah.
So was there a number theory group there already?
There was a number theorist there.
Ah, okay.
And the year after that, we hired a fellow who had been a postdoc. Now, he was a postdoc the year I was a first-year faculty member. He was a postdoc at LSU with Gordon Paul. His name was Charles Perry. And he applied to Virginia Tech for a 1-year position, for a term mm-hmm. position. I don't know if it was 1 year or 2 years or whatever. But we hit it off right away, and we wrote several papers together. Mm-hmm. And the time came to do some permanent hirings. I requested and beseeched, and they hired Charles. And he and I were colleagues from 1971 until, I'm sorry to say, his untimely death last year in December. He was a wonderful colleague. Mm-hmm. And we were both interested in number theory, quadratic forms, and he was interested in algebraic number theory. I made the transition very nicely. Mm-hmm. And we traded off teaching number theory, and there was one of Alfred Brower's students from North Carolina, a fellow named Jim Shockley, who had written a book on number theory and published a paper, mm-hmm. and he was on the faculty, and we formed a little group. Mm-hmm. And and then we started hiring other people in discrete mathematics. David Rozelle, who wrote me a letter of recommendation for my job, mm-hmm. Came to Virginia Tech as a senior, as a full professor in combinatorics. And then we hired some more combinatorialists, and it was he who, and a couple of years earlier, one of the applied mathematicians encouraged me to teach a course in graph theory. Mm-hmm. And so, and now we have several combinatorialists, mm-hmm. young combinatorialists, who are mm-hmm. going to burn up the world. They're mm-hmm. just fabulous. Mm-hmm. And, but yeah, my focus was research. Mm-hmm. But a wonderful thing happened my second year that still affected my career as a teacher. And that was they had it in their heads that I could teach honors calculus. Mm-hmm. And they asked, "Do you want to teach an honors section of calculus?" Yeah, mm-hmm.
Sure.
Okay, so I walk into this classroom. This is the fall of 1970, mm-hmm. an awfully long time ago, in a galaxy far away, as they say. And I looked out at that room, and there were about 24 students. And the energy in that crowd, they were eager and anticipating, and the energy that class just sparkled. Mm-hmm. From those 24 students, I know of at least a half a dozen PhDs mm-hmm. in various fields. Mm-hmm. One of them is a PhD in statistics who came back and is now a tenured faculty member mm-hmm. at Virginia Tech. Another got a mm-hmm. PhD in physics and went off and did great things mm-hmm. and he's now elsewhere. And I'm mm-hmm. in contact with about 6 or 7 students mm-hmm. from that very first honors calculus mm-hmm. class I taught 41 years ago. And mm-hmm. it was the thought of that outstanding class that kept me hopeful that there'd be another one like that mm-hmm. along the way. And mm-hmm. sure enough, in the spring of 2001, I taught an honors class in multivariable calculus mm-hmm. that was similarly mm-hmm. crackling and mm-hmm. and so I always thought the teaching was I always considered myself a teacher, even when I wasn't very good.
So when you're talking about when you got weren't so good,
right?
When you got those evaluations,
bad evaluations, yeah.
That was after having taught for quite a while.
That was after having taught for quite a while. That was after having been promoted to full professor, yes. Which I knew was the ultimate promotion. Yes. I was thinking, now what? Mm-hmm. Now what? And I was kind of depressed.
Mm-hmm.
But just the thing happened. Nothing succeeds like disaster.
But clearly you'd had success before.
Yeah, I had. You? Right. But I'd never really poured my soul into it.
Right, yes. All right, so the logical question at this point is,
yeah,
where did baking cookies for your...
biscuits.
Biscuits.
Where did the biscuits.
Biscuits for your students
come the biscuits. That, yeah, biscuits of number theory, right. Where did that come from? Well, when I was a kid, my grandmother would serve me biscuits and syrup.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the fact is, they came out of a can. Grandma was blind, but she could bake.
Mm-hmm.
She also taught me to read, even though she was mm-hmm. blind. That's another story.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved biscuits.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife didn't bake biscuits.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't, you know, ask her or anything like that. One fine morning in the mm-hmm. fall of sometime in the early 80s, on Saturday morning, I sat down at the breakfast table. And I said, I'd like some biscuits for breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
And two boys were there. They were, you know, early teenagers. My wife looks at me and says, "I don't do biscuits." Oh. And then she said those fateful words, "Well, why don't you make them yourself?" With the unspoken, "You dolt." I said, "Okay, I'll try." So I tried. And they were extreme failures.
Mm-hmm.
This is how bad they were. It dropped them on the floor, they bounced.
Mm-hmm.
Kids called them hockey pucks.
Mm-hmm.
The prize insult was from our golden retriever. Our golden retriever was a sweet, sweet dog. She was friendly. She would eat anything. And she swished over, seeing that biscuit on the floor. And she sniffed at it. And she looked at me. And she turned up her nose and she walked away with her tail swishing as if to say, "Fool me once." Well, eventually I got good at it because
mm-hmm.
it mattered.
Mm-hmm.
And a year I was on sabbatical up in Washington working for a very fine government agency, I started baking biscuits and bringing them in to my colleagues once a week.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of one summer, I think it was summer of 94, two or three of them said, "You've got to keep making the biscuits. How are we going to get our biscuits?" And I thought about it for a minute and I said, "Give me your emails." So seven of these people in that office gave me their emails, and then following Thursday, I sent them the first biscuit, which was an email. I called it a biscuit, and it was a magical biscuit from Chef Ezra's virtual kitchen,
mm-hmm.
chock full of goodies, served with love and affection and friendship and hot coffee and hot butter and so
mm-hmm.
forth and so on like that. And it was a way to keep in touch with these seven
mm-hmm.
people in that office.
Mm-hmm.
And gradually, the list got bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some names that you would recognize on that list. Art Benjamin is... I started calling these people biscuiteers.
Mm-hmm.
There are quite a few in the MAA whom you know. Jenny Quinn,
mm-hmm.
Annalisa Cornell,
mm-hmm.
Art, Ed Berger, Tensia Soto Johnson is a biscuiteer. Talithia Williams is a biscuiteer. Sam Vandervell is a biscuiteer. And this is a list of colleagues from all sorts of parts of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Friends from college, friends from high school, friends from kindergarten. Relatives, mathematical colleagues from all over. Virginia Tech alumni, former students of mine, and a bunch of folks who worked for the government.
Mm-hmm.
And person here, person there, about 125, 130 of them now. And I just, every once in a while, I send something out.
Mm-hmm.
Used to be every week. I ran out of ideas. So, and also I started doing a lot of other things. But mm-hmm. I send it out. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Every once in a while, Susan Wildstrom's on the list.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Tanton's on the list. You know, folks that I think, well, you know, I like to stay in touch with these people for some reason mm-hmm. or other. And it's kind of idiosyncratic.
But it's a fascinating transition from the concrete to the abstract.
From the concrete to the abstract, yes. Yeah. Which is a...
concrete in several senses.
Yeah, well, they started out concrete, but they got kind of soft. And when mm-hmm. Art and I were editing this collection of number theory mm-hmm. papers, which we really enjoyed,
mm-hmm.
We had... we called them Gems of Number Theory. We were going to call mm-hmm. the book Gems of Number Theory.
Mm-hmm.
And the response... I mean, the response from the editorial board of the Dulciani
mm-hmm.
Series was, it's a nice book. It's coming along. Do this, do this, do this, do this, do this. Change the title.
Mm-hmm.
These aren't gems. What's gem? Fermat's Last Theorem's a gem. Oh, okay, we got the message. Although there are a couple of articles in this collection about Fermat's mm-hmm. Last Theorem, including the last one in the book called A Marvelous Proof by Fernando Gouveia. Mm-hmm. So Art and I said, well, what are we going to do? What are we going to call this? How about Pretty Good Papers in Number Theory? Some neat number theory. And Art said, well, let's call it Biscuits of Number Theory. Well, that's a good working title. I said, yeah, you know, that makes some sense. He said, sure. What's a biscuit? Well, the ones I make nowadays are kind of tasty.
Mm-hmm.
They're not very big, easily digestible,
mm-hmm.
and they make you hungry for more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we batted this idea around. I said, what the heck? We'll call it that for now.
Mm-hmm.
So we sent back the revised manuscript, and they all said, love the title!
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of began almost as a half joke, but right. Now it's a title. And it manned the transition from concrete on the floor, which a
yeah.
dog wouldn't eat,
right.
to virtual biscuits. And I still mm-hmm. make biscuits for students yeah. every once in a while.
Mm-hmm. One other aspect, music.
Oh.
You play the piano now.
I do.
was that something you did all along? Or
I started at 16.
Uh-huh.
I was interested in learning to play the piano because a new kid came into our high school. He could play the piano by ear. And he was very popular at parties,
mm-hmm.
especially with the young ladies.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, gee, I can learn to do that, and then I'll be popular with the young ladies.
Mm-hmm.
So I taught myself to play the piano by mm-hmm. ear, listening to records. I had a pretty good ear, and I could read music.
Your mother, who... couldn't play the piano.
My mother could play the piano. She didn't play by ear. She didn't insist that I take music lessons
mm-hmm.
because, as she said, when I was a little girl, I took piano lessons and I hated them.
Mm.
So I made up my mind that no child of mine would be forced to take piano lessons. And she said, and when you came to me and said, Mom, I need some lessons, she said, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. Hear this child of mine asking me for piano lessons. And so she hooked me up with her old piano teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I had half a dozen lessons, learned
mm-hmm.
to play a Bach two-part invention.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I could coordinate the hands reasonably
mm-hmm.
well, and a lot of the rest was practice.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talented enough,
mm-hmm.
let's put it that way. I can play by ear. And I've taken part in one musical production where I was a pianist.
Mm-hmm.
And you know about that.
Yeah. And very successful it was.
It was a hoot.
Yeah.
What else can I tell you?
Future.
Future.
What are you looking forward to doing?
Well, you know, I don't know. Something like Wilkins McCauver always used to say in David Copperfield, well, something will turn up.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always been somebody along the way to point the way.
Mm-hmm.
Go this way.
Mm-hmm.
Go that way. You want to do this. And they've always been there.
You've got to be amenable to
you have
attention.
You have to pay attention. That's right. I mean, my son was in graduate school in a field he was sort of interested in, and he was kind of wasting away his life, and he got a phone call from his first cousin, David.
Mm-hmm.
Called him up at his graduate school and said, Ben, why don't you come out and work for me and help me with my computers and help me with my accounting and bookkeeping and all that? And as Ben said later on, I recognized a lifeline when
mm-hmm.
somebody threw it to me.
Mm-hmm.
And he went out there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, been out there a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Got a job, got a condo along the way, acquired a very nice girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
You know. He recognized... Yeah. You got to recognize the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people have given me the opportunities along the way. And sometimes you recognize
them.
Mm-hmm. You know. Something will come along.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in this occupation for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
This is my 43rd year at Virginia Tech. I calculated if I make it to 48 years, I think, yeah, and retire after 48 years, that I will have been at that university for more than one-third of its entire existence. It was founded in 1872.
Mm-hmm.
I worked that out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'll do that.
Now, if you'd been hired earlier,
yeah,
you wouldn't need as many years.
That's true. Yeah, right. And you can teach a snake to tap dance if you can figure out how to get it to wear shoes.
That's right.